Number 75, The Unjust Steward, Luke 16, verses 1 to 12. This parable has been the subject of many ingenious and various interpretations. The steward has been regarded as signifying the Jewish priesthood, Pilate, Judas, Paul, and even Jesus himself. The tax collectors and penitents, as counterparts of the steward, have also found advocates. The rich owner has been thought to represent God, Satan, the Romans, and Mammon. The devil is certainly in the story, but it is as the steward's accuser, the verb from the word diabolos. It can be imagined from the mere catalogue of these various applications of the owner and the steward that many different interpretations have been given to the details of the story. Any interpretation given to the parable must take account of Christ's references to serving Mammon, of the Pharisees' evident application of the story to themselves, since they derided Jesus, being, as Luke narrates, covetous. Also of verses 16 to 18 which follow, and which at first sight seems so unconnected. The story concerns the steward of a rich man. The full management of his master's estate was in his hands, the letting of the farms and the trading of the produce. He was accused of wasting his master's goods, and was therefore called to present an account of his stewardship. The precise circumstances and duties of a steward, and why he was called to account, have been variously explained. Probably the account demanded by the Lord was intended to substantiate, or disprove, the accusations which had been made against the steward. And the steward, knowing that his conduct would not bear investigation, recognized that the enquiry would lead to dismissal. He therefore began to think how he could meet the new situation. He ruled out digging and begging as possible solutions, and then bethought himself of a way by which he would have some claim on the debtors of his master. He called them to him and reduced their debts. It is possible, but far from certain, that the amount of reduction represented the overcharge he had made, his roguery extending to both master and tenant. In this case, by his action, he rectified in measure some of his defalcations, and also laid the debtors under an obligation. His master heard of his astute, resourceful handling of the situation, and commended him for his prudence and shrewdness. The man was a rogue. His master was a man of the world, and understood the clever effort to make the best of the position. The morality of it does not appear to have interested him. The system in operation at that time of farming out tax collecting provided many opportunities for extortion. The tax gatherers as a class grew rich by extortion. Zacchaeus recognized his sin and made restitution. The people who heard Jesus would thus be familiar with circumstances which correspond with the story. Jesus did not commend the man's conduct. On the contrary, he emphasized this necessity for faithfulness. Verse 11. The parable ends in the middle of verse 8. The second half is the beginning of Christ's comment, which is based on the commendation of the Lord of the steward for his shrewdness. For, says Jesus, the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. The sentence has to be completed. Then the children of light are with reference to their generation. The men of the world who have their portion in this life are quick to discern what will be of advantage to them. The steward knew the men he was dealing with. They saw the advantage he offered. All were concerned with a benefit for themselves. The children of light do not show a corresponding resourcefulness concerning the spiritual things to which their enlightenment has related them. They are sons of light, because of the light of the knowledge of God's purpose has shone in their hearts. They are thus related to far more important things than are the children of darkness. But while knowing the greater value of the future good compared with any present possession, few act consistently with such knowledge. Most men are limited to the horizon of present things, but make the best of the present with acumen and enterprise. The light of the gospel extends the horizon to the future, but without, in many cases, bringing an extension of outlook or of the enterprise that belong to the wider view. The present circumstances, action, and motive. Bullinger suggests that verse 9 should be a question, and I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail they may receive you into everlasting habitations? No. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. Verse 10. This makes such excellent sense that it is a strong temptation to adopt it. The general sense of the Authorized Version is supported, however, by other translations, and this also yields sense in keeping with other testimonies. Following the Authorized Version, the words of Jesus are counsel, which contrasts with the steward's action. The man used money unscrupulously for present advantage. Jesus says that money must be so used that friends are gained, that in this way a man may secure that future which is known to the children of light. The account of the judgment in Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46, illustrates the meaning. And Paul's words also are relevant when he says, "Charge them that are rich in this world, that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy." The 1st of Timothy 6, verse 17. On the latter interpretation, verse 10 becomes a qualifying rule. In all the use of money, faithfulness must be firmly observed. The present is the training for the future, and the quality of faithfulness shown now will secure the greater opportunities and responsibilities of the future age. The present is represented by unrighteous mammon, and the future by true riches, verse 9, with the further definitions as that which is another man's and that which is your own. Unrighteous mammon is wealth, called the mammon of unrighteousness, not because wealth is in itself wrong, but because it has such a power of corrupting men and leading them into unrighteousness. True riches are the future possessions of the people of God, of which even the hope is likened to a treasure in earthen vessels. Mammon is another man's in the sense that no man has a permanent title to present possessions, whereas the future true riches are the inheritance for ever of those who attain to that future age. Jesus adds warning to these lessons, a warning the force of which we miss if we fail to remember that by service Jesus is thinking of the bondage of the slave. No bond slave can serve two masters. In the nature of the case, it is impossible. A man today might serve two masters at different periods of the day, but a bond slave was at the full disposal of his owner. Any effort on the part of a slave to serve two masters would lead to a divided loyalty. Jesus says, You cannot serve God and mammon. Wealth easily enslaves, for great possessions soon provide a desire for still more, and avarice is a vice which holds a man fast. If a rich man would acceptably serve God, he must be master and not slave to his possessions. So far the application has been made to riches. It is so made by Jesus. But men are stewards not only of material wealth, but of the mysteries of God's grace. It is required of stewards, Paul affirms, that a man be found faithful. From this angle, the application by some expositors of the steward to the Jewish priesthood should be considered. This interpretation will be found to have a real connection with the story. It also gives it a parabolic meaning. Instead of making it merely an illustration by contrast concerning duty towards human wealth. The Pharisees were covetous, as Luke says. The chief priests were also men of great wealth, which they used to maintain relations of mutual toleration with the Roman rulers. Caiaphas managed to retain his office for 18 years. The priestly party were not only wealthy, but were also oppressive and arrogant, besides being favourable to Roman overrule, so long as the Romans kept them in office. The Talmud preserves some of the woes which the people pronounced upon the house of Annas, for their club and for their fist. For they are the high priests, their sons are the treasurers, their sons-in-law are temple officers, and their servants beat the people with their staves. In the parable, the steward reduced the bills of the master's debtors for present advantage. The priests of Israel lowered the obligations to God, altering the standards of righteousness. A good illustration may be seen in the Korban law. By legal fiction, they gave to God anything which they ought to have used for the benefit of their parents, and so escaped the duty of honouring father and mother. Jesus very severely reprimanded this as teaching for doctrine the commandments of men, and making void the word of God. Matthew 15, verses 1 to 9. The priests were stewards, but they acted in a worldly wise way, which was unfaithful to God's appointment. They served mammon, not God. And in this larger interpretation of the parable, mammon must stand for all the desires which the flesh lusts after. They served self. The parable, though spoken to the disciples, follows immediately after the indictment of the Pharisees, drawn in the character of the elder brother of the parable in chapter 15. While then cast in the form of ordinary stewardship, the parable reflects the unfaithful, selfish shrewdness of some of those who were listening to Jesus. How does this view fit with the words that follow? They derided him, turned up their noses at him. And Jesus responded, "Ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts." They thought to put themselves right with their fellows, to be well thought of, to be highly esteemed. But their standard of judgment was wrong, and God would judge their hearts. As they were stewards, an account was required. The religious service they sought to maintain, for which they were even ready to sacrifice a righteous man, John 19, verses 4 to 6, had become an abomination to God and would pass away. When Jesus was speaking, the transition period had indeed come, for the law and the prophets were until John. That is, that dispensation when God's will declared by law and prophets was operative. But a new message with new conditions was being proclaimed. The kingdom was preached, and men were pressing into it, verse 16. This did not mean that because the law was superseded, it was not authentic or authoritative. This is shown by the word but, revised version. But it is easier for heaven and earth to pass than one tittle of the law to fail, verse 17. Even the little horns, the seraphs of the letters, would not fail. The next verse, with reference to divorce as so commonly practiced by even the scribes and rabbis, is in the nature of a counter-thrust. The teaching of Jesus, the sayings of which so often appear disconnected, many times presents a logical sequence of reasoning when the thought links are supplied. In this case, in effect, he says, I am not destroying the law, but fulfilling it. But you have widened the conditions of divorce so much that many, while nominally married, are really no better than adulterers. This verse, thus understood, is also an illustration of the writing down of the debt men owe. The story of the unjust steward and the comments that follow are thus an indictment of a priesthood which had betrayed a trust for their own selfish ends. The very method of selling sacrificial animals and changing money in the temple court reveal an unfaithfulness in financial matters. What right had they to deal with spiritual matters, the true riches? God had set apart a court for Gentiles. They had taken it for dishonest uses. How could they claim to serve God? The parable of the rich man and Lazarus that follows then becomes a sentence of judgment which is irrevocable. Further lessons become apparent when we consider that the knowledge of God's salvation imposes a stewardship. The truth is bartered for present advantage when the light is obscured because faithful testimony would be followed by some financial loss. A man sells his soul who lowers the ethical standards of Christ's teaching for more business. Better less wealth and faithfulness than riches and rejection by Christ. The early Christians became unfaithful when, for present gain, they adopted pagan practices. When idolatry was involved in attending a guild dinner, when festivals were held in idol temples, a Christian accepted invitations to these gatherings only by lowering the values of his service to Christ. Worship Caesar was a test of loyalty to Christ which might cost life when losing life was the only way of gaining life. The formula, Jesus is Lord, was a challenge to the lords many of the pagan world. It was also a test of faith for the first century Christian. The time came when saints and angels and the souls of dead men were worshipped, and the truth of God was betrayed. Are we today in no danger of copying the unjust steward by lowering the demands the Lord has made? In commercial dealings, in moral life, in the stewardship of God's grace?